Hello, listeners, and welcome to another edition of the Built on the Border podcast. It is Monday, June 15th. A little bit of a dreary, rainy day here in Kansas City, Missouri, and I'm joined once again by my roommate, co-host, and close friend, Mr. Tommy Watson. Tommy, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. It's great to be back for this week.
Yeah, of course, we missed you for last week's taping. Brody and I had to do it solo, but you just spent a nice little weekend in Omaha at the College World Series. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
It was a pretty cool experience. I would highly recommend it to anybody who gets a chance to, especially if you live in the Midwest. Omaha is a pretty easy drive, no matter if you're coming from Chicago or Kansas City, definitely. But it's real fun. You know, you go down there, the stadium is beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's a fairly new stadium down in downtown Omaha there. And there's basically beer gardens, like, every block surrounding the stadium. It's fun. There's a huge party. You just kind of roll from one to the other. And then if you really want to go to the game, it's actually not unreasonable. I looked online for tickets before I went up there, and you can get a ticket for like $50 or something, but you can go up to the stadium, and usually before games they actually have general admission tickets for $10 or something, and you can always find a ticket scalper. It's a very attendable game,
yeah,
I should say.
And it always sounds like a lot of fun. Which fan base do you think, or did you notice, was the most highly represented this weekend at the College World Series?
It's kind of hard to tell, because I know it's a kind of a big thing for just Omaha people to go to in general, so there's not necessarily a lot for one fan base. But I noticed there were many Arkansas fans, decent amount of LSU people.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's kind of hard to tell. And, plus, I was never in the game, so I would have had to look at the crowd when I was watching the game and don't always show the crowd that much.
Right. Well, it sounds like you had a good weekend in Omaha. I think it's one of those things you kind of – it's on a bucket list if you're a Midwesterner or you're a college sports fan. It's kind of one of those things you have to make it to at some point, getting down to Omaha – or up to Omaha, I guess, to see the College World Series. We are now joined by Brody Johnson, who's a little late due to the inclement weather we've been having recently. But he's now joined us in studio, as we say. Talking about the sports action from this week. Big Sunday night last night. We had the new Game of Thrones episode, new Silicon Valley episode. But in the midst of all that, we had to somehow squeeze in watching Game 5 of the NBA Finals, which the Golden State Warriors were victorious in over the Cleveland Cavaliers, winning by 13, playing a pretty solid game throughout, taking care of the Cavaliers pretty handedly. Steph Curry having a big second half for the Warriors last night. So the series is now 3-2, returning to Cleveland for Game 6, which will be played tomorrow night. LeBron James had another huge, huge performance for the Cavaliers. 40 points in 45 minutes of game played. Another triple-double with 14 rebounds, 11 assists. He continues to try to put the team on his back, and it continues to not be enough for the Cleveland Cavaliers. What are your thoughts? I guess I'm going to kind of gauge both your thoughts on where the series stands now, what you expect to see in Game 6, and are we going to see a Game 7?
Well, I personally think that I think we are going to see a Game 7.
Okay.
I think, or at least there's a very good chance, because the series is going back to Cleveland for one more game, and I think that LeBron does have a chance. He has the ability to win a game for the Cavs, although, I mean, it's pretty much all him doing it right now. They do have the ability, because we've already seen that if Steph Curry just struggles a little bit, it kind of evens the playing field out and gives the Cavs a way better shot of actually winning.
Mm-hmm.
But I could also see on the flip side of that, if Steph puts up just, you know, a game just like last night where he didn't score a ton necessarily, but he was very efficient, shot well in the second half, like you said, and they could easily win in Game 6, too.
Well, he did score a ton. I mean, Steph had 37 points last night. So, I mean, he had kind of the breakout performance we were waiting for him to have in the finals. He really did carry his team, whereas the other guys that were kind of carrying the team in previous games were guys like Andre Iguodala and Harrison Barnes. But we kind of saw a collective effort from the Warriors last night, everyone kind of doing their part, which is what we were waiting to see, because we know how talented this team is from top to bottom. You know, Andrew Bogut didn't even play in game five, so it's kind of a shift in what you're seeing out there, for the Warriors. Brody, what are your thoughts on how you see this series playing out tomorrow night and then possibly into a game seven.
Well, my prediction right off the bat from last week and 2 weeks ago, a game five final, that obviously was wrong.
Right.
But I'm going to have to go with what you said last week, where it's a game six. I don't see the Cavaliers with seven players, even though LeBron as being the greatest player in the country.
In the world,
to carry this team as he did in game five. Don't see it happening again.
And it's just, it's interesting the way this Cavaliers team is assembled, because they have a really good front court right now. You know, they have LeBron James playing at a high level. They have Tristan Thompson playing at a high level. He had 19 points on 6 of 11 shooting, 7 and 10 from the free throw line on Sunday evening. But they're not getting a whole lot of backcourt support. J.R. Smith played 36 minutes. He had 14 points, but he was also 5 of 15 from the field, 4 of 14 from 3. You had Iman Shumpert, who played 37 minutes. He only gave you 10 points, 2 assists, 1 steal. You look at the plus-minuses of some of these guys that are in the backcourt for Cleveland, including Matthew Dellavedova, who was playing out of his mind in the early part of this series, that aren't playing up to that level anymore. Mm-hmm. I think you're starting to see, one, the fatigue start to show in the Cavaliers, and two, the injuries are really starting to stack up for them as well. I mean, when you have guys that aren't playing due to injury, you know, notably Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving, and you're starting guys like Matthew Dellavedova in a pivotal Game 5 matchup, that's when you really see you see these guys starting to come back down to earth. You see these teams starting to come back to reality, and you see the pundits starting to realize, everyone who was praising Matthew Dellavedova, well, he's not as good as he was playing in games 1 and 2 or even Game 3.
I mean, it's difficult to maintain that level, but that was more of an outlier than...
And I think that's what people failed to realize when they were calling this series, is that the Warriors are a team that depends on a successful... you have to have a successful offense to win when you're the Warriors. They are the best defensive team in the league, and they have the highest point differential in the league all season. The reason they have such a high point differential is because their defense is so good, but also because their offense outscores people. There were games where this entire season where Steph Curry didn't even really play the entire fourth quarter, and he still was putting up MVP-type numbers. We didn't get to see that in the series thus far until really last night, and that's when Steph Curry came live in the fourth quarter and kind of buried the Cavaliers. Now you're starting to see this Warriors team, which I've said is kind of a team of destiny in terms of the way everything has gone right for them this year. They're starting to be that team again. You see efficient ball movement. You see them running the game at the pace in which they want to run it at. And I think that just LeBron James playing hero ball isn't enough to throw them off their rhythm, because you watch the Warriors in these last two games and they are on pace. The pacing of the game seems normal for them. They seem comfortable. Steph Curry has kind of started to figure out that high double team off the high screen roll that the Cavs are trying to do, and the Cavs really don't have an answer for it anymore. So I'm gonna have to go with Brody, like I've been saying for the last 2 weeks. This is going to a game six. It will be a close game six. It'll probably be a game six for the ages. But I think that Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, Harrison Barnes, the guys that have been playing well in this series thus far, Andre Iguodala, will continue to play at this high level, because that's what we've come to expect from them. If you look at a sample size of Andre Iguodala's career, while he didn't start for the Warriors until the finals this season, you have an entire track record of him performing at a high level. He's been an all-star, he's been on Team USA, but he was relegated to a bench role for this team. So you can understand if he's able to keep this elevated level of play up. But when you look on the other side of the coin and you say, well, Matthew Dellavedova had these great Game 1 and Game 2 performances, well, he doesn't have that proven track record to really support that he can continue that. And so that's why I'm going to continue to say the Warriors win this in six. I don't see a Game 7. Although, like I've said before, as sports fans, that's what we want to see. We want to see a Game 7. We want to see intrigue. We want to see it go down to that final, that final 48 minutes of basketball. But I just don't think that the Cavaliers have the gas or the firepower to get there. So shifting away from the NBA, we'll talk about that more next week once we have a determined NBA champion, and we'll talk about the NBA draft, which is coming up in just 10 short days. So that is coming quickly upon us. To some other NBA news, stay on the topic of basketball news today, or over the weekend from the Philadelphia 76ers camp. 2014 number 3 overall pick by the Philadelphia 76ers, Joel Embiid, may have to sit out the entire 2015-2016 season. Nothing's definite. Nothing's finite. It may just be he needs some additional rest and additional therapy to heal that foot. But this foot, which he had to have his navicular bone repaired on, is continuing to present problems. I guess as a KU fan, you obviously want to see Joel Embiid be healthy and be, have an impact in the NBA like we're seeing his classmate Andrew Wiggins have, both drafted in that 2014 draft class. Tommy, what are your concerns looking at now what another injury for Joel Embiid? First it was the back, now it's the foot. What are your expectations now with another setback?
Well, I'm very worried for him now because I think we've seen with, you know, Greg Oden was injury prone and he's never really, his career's never really gotten off the ground. And it worries me with Embiid that it's his foot, especially his foot that's hurt, because I believe one of those high praises coming out of college was his footwork,
right?
Which any kind of nagging injury could really keep slow you down in that aspect and not let you perform the way you thought you could perform.
Mm-hmm. And we've seen other superstars have this type of injury before, but they weren't guys with the behemoth frame like Joel Embiid. And they talk about doctors' concern over that injury because he's, you know, at his lightest, he's like a 260-pound center. And that's a lot of weight to be putting on that bone, which can get fragile. So the growing concern is that if this is a recurring injury, he may never even see the floor. You know, of course, obviously that's not what we hoped is going to happen. But it's becoming I would not be surprised at this point in his career if we, in 2 to 3 years, are reading headlines, Joel Embiid is like, I wouldn't be surprised if we were reading similar headlines that we read about Greg Oden in the last 5 to 6 years about how he just never was able to get healthy, never able to maintain and stay on the floor. But we wanted to touch on it briefly just because it is a Kansas guy. We're obviously hoping for the best, but the concern is there for Joel Embiid. And obviously he factors heavily into the Philadelphia 76ers' future plans. Otherwise they would not have drafted him as high as they did. So you want to see a franchise that has really been just kind of failing to produce a viable product, a talented product on the floor, to lose one of the guys that they were heavily invested in for their future. It's just a little disappointing, not just as a basketball fan, but as a sports fan, to see that type of injury take, possibly take away someone's career and take something away from that fan base in Philadelphia. So moving away from the NBA now, we want to go ahead and talk about the Royals, who continue to impress us both on the field and off the field. They finished a 3-game sweep of the Minnesota Twins on Wednesday night, which put us into first place in the division. Then we faltered a little bit in St. Louis, losing 2 out of the 3 games, and we didn't even get to play a third because it was rained out. But the Royals do still sit atop the division, and they do still maintain the best record in the American League. So all things are still positive in terms of a win-loss scenario for the Royals. Things also still staying positive. We have 8 Royals that are leading the All-Star vote this year for their respective positions, including Omar Infante, who currently has a batting average of .204, so just barely over the Mendoza line. So the Royals, as it would stand today, would have 8 starters in the All-Star game, starting for the American League, starting with Salvador Perez at catcher, Eric Hosmer at first, Omar Infante at second base, Escobar at shortstop, Mike Moustakas at third base, Gordon in left field, Kane in right field or center field, and then Mike Trout being that third outfielder for the Kansas City All-Stars, essentially. But for the American League All-Stars, Mike Trout would be the only non-Royal starting the All-Star game. So before I go to Tommy to get your thoughts on it, Brody, what are your thoughts on this just such an impressive performance by Kansas City voters and just kind of this fluke that's currently happening right now with the voting system?
You know, the only thing I really got to say is baseball is back. We are now the capital for baseball. And I mean, maybe not record-wise, maybe not for all of this with St. Louis having the best record in baseball, but our fans were passionate. We've gone to voting every one of our players. Even Rios is fourth in the
outfield voting. So, yeah, it's definitely a positive thing. And I think, Tommy, you may have a little bit of a different spin on it. This was the first time that when I saw the results today that I was actually frustrated because I can make an argument for everybody on that list to be a starter except for Omar Infante. So what are your thoughts on Omar currently leading the second baseman vote?
I have no problem with it because it's a flawed system to begin with. I've never liked the fan vote because it used to be the Royals players we'd have 1 or 2 guys who were definitely deserving to start and just couldn't get in because we've never had the enthusiasm, I think, and the overall population.
Yeah.
Yeah, the overall population of the city, really, to vote our players in. But now that they've gone to this all online thing and they've just encouraged everyone to vote. And apparently Kansas City is the only one who's taking that to heart.
Right.
And they're making up for years of frustration, it seems like.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have no problem with it because I'm hoping they'll change the system next year.
Right. I understand the frustration if you're an Indians fan or you're a Reds fan or you're, you know, this is talk. I'll just stick with the American League. I don't understand the frustration if you're a Twins fan, if you're an Indians fan. Hell, if you're even a Mariners fan and your players are deserving. I'd be frustrated if I, you know, was trying to vote Nelson Cruz into the All-Star game. I'd be frustrated if I was trying to vote Jason Kipnis into the All-Star game. I'd be frustrated if I was trying to vote Jose Altuve into the All-Star game and these guys weren't getting the recognition that they deserved. But I don't have sympathy for people that are saying, oh, well, Mark Teixeira should be playing in the All-Star game. Miguel Cabrera should be playing in the All-Star game. Well, you know what? Get off your ass, Detroit, New York, Boston. If you think Pedroia deserves to play second base in the All-Star game, well, why don't you get one of the most heavily populated cities in the country to go out and vote for their player? Why don't you get one of the largest fan bases in the country to go out and vote for your player? It's like somebody complaining that, you know, somebody from Los Angeles complaining the Cardinals have too many players starting for the National League. Well, guess what, Los Angeles? You have way more people than St. Louis does. Hey, guess what, New York and Boston? You have way more fans than Kansas City, Cleveland, Houston. You have a way bigger fan base than they do. Go out and vote if it really pisses you off so much. I don't buy this whole notion, well, this is showing the fan vote's flawed for the first time. No, it's showing that most fan bases have gotten spoiled and are lazy and just expect the national popularity of these players to get them in. Well, guess who's the most popular team in baseball this year? The Kansas City Royals. And if you want to argue that, just look at the numbers of who's voting, who's getting voted in.
Right.
Votes. This is not just a Kansas City vote that's happening right now. The whole country is voting for us. Alex Gordon kind of talked about it the last time he was interviewed on this subject. He said, look, we garnered a lot of admiration and respect and fandom from all these people around the country last year when they went on this amazing run. And I continue to say it. There's a reason that the Royals are the most popular team in baseball. They play a gritty style. They play a fun style of baseball. They legitimately look like they're having fun when they're out there on the baseball, on the diamond. So I don't think that these big cities can really be that, you know, offended or upset by this because we go out and vote just as much as we're allowed to. It's not like we're hacking the system and putting in false numbers. We're just going out and we're voting. It's like saying that, the Republican president should be not elected because he's the better candidate. But guess what? If Republicans aren't voting, then he doesn't get to be president. That's just how it works. And if you have a problem with it, then get off your ass and vote. I mean, Kansas City fans are rocking the vote right now. I think we are teaching other fans in baseball how to approach this. You shouldn't be blamed because you opened up 4 email accounts and decided to vote, you know, 140 times. That's not our fault. If you don't have the passion and the time to go out and vote that many times, that's not our fault. And I don't think Kansas City fans should be getting a bad reputation because they're going out and they're proud of their players and they want to see their guys represented.
Yeah, you know, I really don't like the people that are bagging on us for stuff in the ballot box.
Right.
They encourage people to stuff the ballot box.
Right.
35 votes a day, they don't really verify the email addresses, so I don't even think some email addresses have to even be true or real email addresses.
I don't know about that. I haven't read that. But, you know, I have, you know, 4 different work email accounts. I have a personal email. I have my old school email. I've used all of those. I've maxed those out. And then I've used our email at builtontheborder@gmail.com.
Nice.
Builtontheborder@gmail.com. I used that one to vote. So I'm getting so sick of the notion that, well, Kansas City fans are poor, are you know, they don't respect the game. You know what? We respect the game because we're actually going out and voting for our guys. We're proud of our team. We're proud of what these guys have done this season. And yeah, a lot of guys are slumping, and maybe you can really only make a case for 3 or 4 of them to really deserve a spot. And I would say those 3 guys are Hosmer, Moustakas, Perez, and Kane. But there are other guys on there who deserve to at least be in the conversation. And to just discount them because, you know, these are the guys that are kind of the new kids on the block for the first time, you know, it's unfair. And I think the other fan bases just need to suck it up and go out there and do what they're supposed to, which is go out there and vote for their players. Cardinals fans are doing the same. They know how this goes. They vote their guys in because they want to see their guys out there. They're proud of their players. I don't think we should be penalized. The Royals fans should be penalized from a reputation standpoint because we care. I kind of soapboxed that a little bit. But that's kind of the way I think the whole city's been feeling, the whole fan base has been feeling about this. We're kind of getting ragged on because we're actually doing what we're supposed to do. So that's my frustration.
Yeah, and you know, I had one more thought on it. So a lot of people are basically worried about this game being, you know, basically the Royals versus the NL All-Stars. They're saying we're going to lose the game, but I don't really see that happening necessarily or that even making a difference because... So they'll play, our Strollers will play maybe one or two innings,
right,
which is an at-bat or two maybe for some guys.
Mm-hmm.
And then on defense, we have the best defense in baseball, so I don't know why you would be frustrated that it's all our guys. And then once our guys get pulled, then we're putting in these guys that are just as good, the guys who should have been voted in maybe, and they're going to be facing like the National League relievers and stuff. And then, oh, I forgot. We're going to have an American League starter. Like, the best starter in the American League should be making a start for us. So, if he goes out there and throws well, he's got a great defense behind him, I don't believe anybody who would say that we're going to cause us to lose this game.
Right. And you know, then it gives those guys, those people who you think, you know, should be playing in the game, like Adam Jones, Nelson Cruz, Mark Teixeira, Miguel Cabrera, it gives them an opportunity to give us some run support. You know, so I still... don't want to see Omar Infante start in the All-Star game. I know there are some people that do. But I am okay with the other seven guys starting. And I actually would prefer to see them all start, except for Omar Infante. So that's enough on the Royals. We don't want to bore people too much with how upset we are with the national reaction to the Royals, because we obviously think those guys should be in there. And we don't think anyone should have a different opinion than us on that. But we want to go ahead and get into the pop culture part of the podcast because it was a big night for television last night. It was a big night for television just because of one TV show, and that was Game of Thrones, the season 5 finale, which had a lot of interesting, heartbreaking, stomach-churning material in it. And it all had been kind of building up to this penultimate episode in which some people that we were big fans of didn't make it. So we'll go ahead and preface this by saying this is going to be a segment where we reveal some things that happen. Spoiler alert, we will reveal who dies at the end of this season. So if you are, if you are a book reader trying to currently catch up, or you're a show watcher trying to catch up, don't listen to this portion of the podcast, but we will talk about deaths, on-screen deaths in the episode. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about what I didn't like from this season, and we can kind of all share our thoughts on that. But obviously the two big deaths from last night were Stannis Baratheon and Jon Snow. Tommy, as a non-book reader who didn't see the death of Jon Snow coming, what are your thoughts and feelings today, 24 hours later, trying to kind of stomach it, and what are your thoughts on it now, 24 hours in?
Well, you know, I kind of had a second thought about the overall episode with the deaths and stuff because, you know, when you're introducing the topic, you said on-screen deaths, but I thought it was actually very interesting in the episode. A lot of those deaths were actually implied, which mm-hmm. is kind of unusual for the show. Now, I do think that we're going to see that probably most of those people really did die. I think that they might just be trying to mess with us a little bit. Because, you know, we lost Jon Snow last night, and I would say he was maybe the most popular character. Maybe, arguably, he's up there with Tyrion.
Yeah, I'd say they're one and two.
Yeah, so I know I was real upset to lose him, but I find it interesting. He's the one who looked the most dead at the end of it, because there's a part where Stannis dies, but they don't show him.
Right, they don't show his death.
There's a part where you see Myrcella Baratheon has been poisoned, but the last you see of her is her just being held by her dad,
yeah.
Which doesn't necessarily mean she's dead because, as you know, Bronn is on that boat and he had the same poison used on him. So he knows how to, he knows
that
there's an antidote and he knows what it is. Now, whether or not he has that, I don't know.
Right. So there's a lot to kind of look forward to now with season 6. You know, the prevailing theory, and as a book reader, I don't know this, but I don't believe Jon Snow is dead. We don't really know that from the uh, from the books or anything, because there's no indication in the passages from Winds of Winter that Jon Snow is still alive, because it's going to be a big reveal if he's still alive. I think there's a reason why the Lady Melisandre is now back at the Wall. So there's a lot to see, and I just want to kind of critique this season, because there were a lot of things that were rushed, I felt like, this season. And Brody and myself as book readers kind of know what those things were. But for starters, I really wasn't a fan with the Dorne storyline. I think that the prevailing opinion by most show watchers is that it didn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. Now, it did pair up two of the better characters on the show, those being Jaime and Bronn, which made for some really great scenes, some very good banter back and forth. But it also provided us with a pretty stale storyline. I thought the Sand Snakes weren't particularly well acted roles by the actresses they hired to perform those three roles. I did like how it got a chance to introduce some Dornish characters that are important to the storyline, those being Ilaria Sand, who we saw in season 4 but didn't really get to know very well. We now know more about Doran Martell, the brother of the late, great Oberyn Martell, who we last saw getting his head smashed in by the Mountain, Gregor Clegane. And we got to meet Arya Hota, who, as Brody knows, is one of the point of view characters in the books, who kind of has an interesting take on everything that's going on in Dorne. But the storyline, I felt, was only serving enough to develop a relationship between Marcella and Jaime. And even then, it took like 7 episodes to get to that point. And then we saw, obviously, the big reveal last night, where Marcella reveals that she knows that Jaime is actually her father, and that she's actually, in fact, happy about it, which I thought was a really touching scene, followed up by a devastating scene where she dies. I mean, we assume. So that was tough. I didn't like the whole Dorne storyline, and I wish they had kind of done that differently, maybe use some different actresses for the Sand Snakes, maybe relegate their role to a less significant one. Also, where the hell was everyone in Dorne? Is it like a population of like 20 people? Because it seemed like there was no one there. It seemed like it was like a subdivision of the Seven Kingdoms. It was just like, you know, there's a group of like 25 Dornish people chilling. When Bronn and Jaime killed those two guys, they cut like the population of Dorne like by like a fifth. Like 20% of it was just gone after that point, I felt like. So that storyline wasn't great for me. The other storyline I didn't particularly like as a book reader, and I know I shouldn't be critiquing the show from this perspective, was Stannis Baratheon's storyline. We all know what he did last week, where he burned his daughter Shireen at the stake, and he paid, you know, dearly for it with the loss of his life this episode. Now, it wasn't one of those things where he got killed because he killed his daughter, but we saw some retribution as a show watcher. We wanted to see something bad happen to Stannis, and we presume that it did. The issue that I take is that the show presented him as this stoic, stone-cold person, but with this genius military mind. He had, you know, we know from the show that he defended Storm's End for a year and ate rats, you know. He ate rats and survived in Storm's End for a year. He took Dragonstone from the Targaryens. He defeated Mance Rayder beyond the Wall and his army. So we know the capabilities that Stannis Baratheon has. And we're really supposed to believe that after 3 weeks of getting stuck in the snow up north, he's just going to burn his daughter because he's run out of options. So that didn't really... I didn't buy that. And he's also one of the more reasonable characters on the show. Yes, he does follow the Red Priestess, Lady Melisandre, almost to a religious fanatic fault. But at the same time, he also understands that what he's doing is for the betterment of the realm and the people that he's trying to serve, not necessarily his own self-serving desires. This season turned him into this empathetic, sympathetic character who clearly had love for his daughter. And then we see everything change. So he's no longer this mastermind. He's no longer willing to stay a little bit longer up in the north and wait for the winter to pass or wait for the snow to pass. He gets rushed. And so this storyline, the whole Stannis thing, didn't really make a lot of sense. And he's also not dead in the books. So I don't know where they know about his storyline going, but his narrative was changed so significantly, I feel like, just to add some shock value to this season. I think they wanted to add the Princess Shireen burning at the stake to add that episode 9 element where something unexpected happens. And you did get that with the Daenerys riding away on Drogon thing. But that was also one of my frustrations. And then the final one was the time they devoted to things in episode 10, because there were a lot of storylines that they needed to tie up. Arya's had to get tied up, at least to some level and to some extent, in the House of Black and White. And then obviously the other one that had to get tied up was Cersei's, which I think they spent too much time on. Brody, we kind of talked about it. What were your thoughts? I thought the penance walk was overkill in terms of, we understood the shame of Cersei. It felt like it took too long. What were your thoughts?
Well, I mean, it was, what, a 10-minute scene?
Yeah.
And for a season finale, for the amount of storylines they're wrapping up, they could have devoted more time to Arya, to any of them.
Right.
And for 10 minutes, you're just seeing a body double walk around naked. And it's like, it's HBO. It's
right.
Understandable, but...
First of all, we were cheated because it wasn't the actual actress that played Cersei. So, what? Why the hell?
But that's not even the point. It's the fact that it was just like, it got overkill.
Right, and it felt...
There was no more shock of...
Right. It was one of those things that I think Game of Thrones now struggles with. How much sexualized content are you going to show? And how much are you going to rely on it as a crutch? And I felt like that was kind of the case... In during that scene. Tommy, as somebody who didn't know that scene was coming, what were your thoughts on the Cersei penance walk?
Oh, I definitely thought it was overkill. I mean, even as a person who, like you said, I haven't read the books, it just, I mean, we got the point. Like,
right.
I mean, I did think they were kind of trying to show just, like, how much, like, shit she took, like, almost literal shit,
because mm-hmm.
she was so dirty when she came back. But I feel like they could have cut that scene probably in half and still accomplished the
right.
same thing.
I mean, I felt like they devoted almost 20, or, you know, not 20%, but 15% of the show to a scene that could have been done in 6 or 7 minutes.
She gets, like, flashed, like, 3 or 4 different times
right.
by guys. Like, they could have done that once,
yeah.
maybe twice,
we
and we
only
gotten
need
the
see,
idea.
Yeah, we only need to see one dick, and then we get it. So,
yeah.
like, that was my problem with this season. Now, obviously, it's still one of the best shows on television. It's one of my favorite shows of all time. But I thought season 5 overall... I give it a C+. Wasn't like the other seasons that have in terms of how entertained I was. I thought season 4 was the best season yet, and season 5 was supposed to deliver something spectacular, and I felt like it didn't. So obviously still excited for season 6, but I'm almost more excited now for the True Detective premiere next Sunday. So enough about Game of Thrones. Brody and I are going to talk a little bit about a movie we saw over the weekend, Jurassic World. We're not going to reveal the spoilers, but we will talk about our thoughts about the movie. I went in with mediocre expectations because I thought that maybe I'd get disappointed because we've been disappointed by a Jurassic Park franchise in the past with Jurassic Park 3. Brody, what were your overall reactions to the movie?
You know, I think it was a great rendition for the 21st century of Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
I mean, now, it wasn't Spielberg directing, but he was an executive producer.
Yeah, he was an executive producer.
And, I mean, you can definitely tell that he had his points and... did the director for Jurassic World, who also did
Safety Not Guaranteed,
which is a great indie film.
Mm-hmm.
But you can definitely tell Spielberg took him under the wing and showed him kind of how he wanted a scene to go, and you can kind of
yeah.
see the Spielberg touch.
Yeah, and I felt like the movie took a lot of things that were great from other Spielberg movies too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Chris Pratt's character kind of had an Indiana Jones feel to it,
right.
to him. The two younger boys, the nephews of Bryce Dallas or Howard's character, they were kind of reminiscent of the two brothers in The Goonies,
mm-hmm.
played by Sean Astin and Josh Brolin, with the kind of badass older brother with the nerdy younger brother kind of. So I felt like it borrowed from a lot of other Spielberg movies and kind of put it all together to make this really magnificent film, and it's blowing away.
Set the Friday box office.
Yeah, and it's already grossed over $550 million worldwide, which is shattering box office records in terms of a global gross. So I think our sentiment would be, after seeing it, go out and see Jurassic World as soon as you can. Great film. The acting in it was great from Chris Pratt, great from Bryce Dallas Howard. And also, I thought Jake Johnson brought a really good comedic element to the movie that I wasn't expecting, and I really enjoyed.
You know, while we were watching, I kind of leaned over and asked you if there was going to be a Jeff Goldblum-esque character, and Jack Johnson...
Jake Johnson.
I think he, maybe not...
He didn't deliver it the same way Dr. Malcolm did in the first one, but it had a little bit of that feel. Now, obviously, Jeff Goldblum's role as Dr. Malcolm, the chaos whatever you call him, chaos scientist, that's, you know, that was a great role in itself. But Jake Johnson delivered a pretty great performance of a guy who was just basically sat behind a control panel the entire movie.
Exactly.
It was really, really good, very suspenseful, and it had that same element that you wanted from the Jurassic from Jurassic Park movies, which is that suspense element. Not necessarily sheer terror and horror, but there's a suspense element to it where you're not sure how the next thing is going to turn. And so I thought it was really, really, really good and really enjoyed that movie.
Wait, when did you guys go see Jurassic World?
We saw it yesterday.
Okay, thanks for inviting me.
We tried to invite you. Right. I called you.
Yeah, 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning. Good time to get a hold of me.
Okay, all right. Here's the thing. We've had this discussion before. I didn't think I needed to leave a message because I thought you would call back.
I don't call back unless people leave messages.
I think that's stupid. I think if you see a missed call from somebody, if it's a number you recognize, you call them back. I wouldn't call back a random number that didn't leave a voicemail message, but if it was a friend who tried to get a hold of me, I'd call them back. Just be like, hey, what's up?
I just figure, like, if it's important, they leave a message. I guess, I mean, seeing a movie's not that important, but...
Well, honestly, I thought it was good enough, I'd go see it again.
I'd definitely go see it
again. Give me a week or two. Okay. Maybe we can see Age of Ultron at the same time. Okay. Since we went and saw it without you two. Is that a good compromise?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Don't be all butthurt. So obviously the last thing to get to tonight is the game 6 between the Blackhawks and Lightning. By the time people are listening to this, it's most likely that there will either be a game 7 determined or the Blackhawks will be crowned as the Stanley Cup champions of the NHL. So big game for the Blackhawks tonight in Chicago, game 6 with a chance to clinch. Tommy, you were saying that you and Brody were both mentioning some stat about it's been a long time since Chicago won in front of their home fans.
Yeah, it was sometime in the 30s. I want to say I saw 34 is the last time they did it where the cup was present, and I want to say it was like 37, maybe. They won it in front of their home fans, but for some reason the trophy was not there.
Huh. Interesting. Well, obviously it's going to be an exciting game. Game 6. It's been an exciting Stanley Cup playoff thus far. I think, you know, you look at the two series before the Stanley Cup, the series went to Game 7s. So, we talk about this all the time. As casual sports fans with no dog in the fight here, we want to see Tampa Bay win tonight because we want to see it go to a Game 7. A lot of my friends who are Blackhawks fans would tend to disagree there. They want to see the Blackhawks win. And a lot of my friends who are in Chicago would love to just burn the city to the ground tonight because knowing Chicago fans, that's what Chicago fans do when they win sports championships. Brody, what do you see as your keys to Game 6 tonight?
I think it's the Blackhawks executing on power plays. Taves and Kane, I think, a dynamic duo for the Hawks. And if they're able to carry it through, take the pounding that the Lightning have been giving them, I think the Hawks win tonight.
Yeah, and we know that Tampa Bay Lightning forward Nikita Kucherov and goalie Ben Bishop did participate in the team's morning skate today, so they are expected to play in Game 6. They've been out for most of this series. Ben Bishop, obviously huge in front of the net for the Lightning. Do you think having them back for Game 6 kind of swings the momentum at all for the Blackhawks?
I think it might maybe energize the Lightning to kind of protect the goalie and keep him out there so he doesn't have to leave the game and have a national media determine what he was leaving the game
for. Yeah, so there was some speculation about that. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, I didn't actually hear a whole lot. I think you were probably...
Yeah, so, well, I read that apparently he had some sort of stomach...
Bladder,
intestinal, rectal issue where he was literally... shitting his pants on the ice. So we don't know how much of that is accurate. Apparently, it was not any sort of gastrointestinal issue. It was an actual injury. But I guess we'll see tonight when he comes out and play, how he performs in Game 6 and hopefully doesn't leave anything. Hopefully he leaves it all on the ice, but not that on the ice. That's what we're hoping for. Yeah. So excited for Game 6. Obviously, want to see Game 7, but if the Blackhawks do win tonight, it will be cool to see those Chicago fans get to watch a championship in front of their home crowd. So that wraps it up for the Built on the Border podcast this week. We want to continue to deliver this podcast to you guys. Hopefully we'll get it out on some different platforms in the near future. We recently have been in discussions with the Fox Sports nationally syndicated website called NoCoastBias.com about getting our podcast promoted on there. So we do want to say thank you to No Coast Bias and their founder, Derek Hernandez, for giving us a little bit of recognition and maybe getting us on a different platform so we can get some more listeners, some more followers. So we're definitely excited to do that. Again, submit any questions or suggestions you have for the show to us at builtontheborder@gmail.com or on Twitter at BorderKC. Like we said, we want this to be an interactive show. We want to get suggestions from the fans on what the fans want to hear us talk about. So if you don't want to hear us talk about Game of Thrones anymore, get on and email us and tell us you don't want to hear any more about Game of Thrones. But I don't know why you wouldn't want to hear more about Game of Thrones. We're going to leave you guys this week with a song by Leon Bridges. The track is entitled Coming Home. Leon Bridges is a guy I'm going to really try and sell you guys hard on. He's kind of this retro soul type artist. Sounds a lot like, you know, R&B legends like Sam Cooke, Otis Redding. So if you guys like that style of music, definitely check him out. Again, this single is titled Coming Home. Can be also be heard on one of the new iPhone 6 commercials. So definitely check it out if you like Sam Cooke or Otis Redding. For Brody Johnson and for Tommy Watson, I'm Tommy Randolph. Have a great week out there, guys. Hopefully we have this weather turn around so you guys can go out there and enjoy the sun that we are obligated to have during the summer months. So keep it real. Have a great week. Peace.
Baby, 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 I'm coming home to your tender, sweet loving. You're my one and only woman. The world needs a bitter taste in my mouth, girl. You're the only one that I want. Take in my mouth, girl, you're the only one that I want. Take in my mouth, girl, you're the only one that I want.